Good morning, Africa. It's Thursday, March 4th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, violence in Myanmar.
Today, it was the bloodiest day since the coup happened on the 1st of February.
Also ahead, we hear from India's protesting farmers.
This countryside vows to support the campaign till the laws are scrapped, however long it takes.
Plus, a look at how Republicans are trying to restrict voting access in the U.S. after losing the presidency. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Myanmar, where the United Nations says 38 people were killed Wednesday in another day of demonstrations against the country's military junta. Six people were killed in the central town of Manua, according to witnesses and media reports. Other protesters were killed in the second largest city of Mandalay, the northern town of Pakhant, and the central town of Mingyan. Security forces used rubber bullets and tear gas to disperse the crowds, with witnesses saying live ammunition was also used against the protesters. Several people were reportedly injured, among them reporter Tet Ong Kant with VOA's Burmese service, who was hit by rubber bullets under his arm as he covered the protests. The UN Special Envoy on Myanmar, Christine Schreiner-Bergener, confirmed Wednesday's death toll as she spoke to reporters from New York.
Today, it was the bloodiest day since the coup happened on the 1st of February. We had only today 38 people died. We have now more than over 50 people died since the coup started, and many are wounded. Altogether, we have around 1,200 people are now detained, and many families don't know where their members of the families are detained, if they are healthy or not. So how can we watch this situation longer?
On Tuesday, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations failed to make a breakthrough in a virtual foreign ministers meeting on Myanmar. While united in a call for restraint, only four members, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Singapore, called for the release of pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other detainees. The United States is calling on military authorities in Myanmar to release an Associated Press journalist and five other members of the media who were detained while covering demonstration against the military coup. The U.S. previously sanctioned the coup leaders and some military companies over the violence. State Department spokesman Ned Price says Washington is considering further policy measures to hold the Myanmar military accountable while attempting to rally an international response. He refers to Myanmar by the country's previous name, Burma.
As reports and shocking images continue to stream in, we are appalled and revulsed to see the horrific violence perpetrated against the people of Burma for their peaceful calls to restore civilian governance. We call on all countries to speak with one voice to condemn brutal violence by the Burmese military against its own people and to promote accountability for the military's actions that have led to the loss of life of so many people in Burma.
Myanmar has been mired in chaos and violence since the military's February 1st overthrow of the civilian government and the detentions of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other high-ranking officials. In Senegal, authorities arrested opposition leader Ousmane Sonko Wednesday. Lauren Anthony of Reuters reports.
Senegal's main opposition leader was arrested on Wednesday after hundreds of his supporters clashed with police while protesting a rape accusation against him. An employee at a beauty salon accused Ousmane Sonko of rape last month. He was summoned for questioning after his parliamentary immunity was removed last week. Former tax inspector Sonko, who enjoys significant support among younger Senegalese, has denied the allegation. He accuses President Macky Sall's government of stirring up the charge to undermine his strongest rival.
What is going on is nothing more than a project to wipe out our democracy. Every time a dictatorship has been allowed to settle and prosper, it is because an overwhelming majority of the people abdicated before a tiny minority, which played on their fears. Nothing can resist the will and courage of people.
Sonko supporters burned tyres and threw rocks at riot police near his house, who responded with tear gas. A Reuters reporter saw two injured protesters, one of whom was bleeding from the head. Sonko's lawyer also said he was accused of disturbing public order and participating in a banned demonstration. The police were not immediately available for comment. Other top rivals of Sal have been targeted by criminal charges in the past, but he denies there has been any political interference in those cases.
Thanks to Lauren Anthony of Reuters for that report. The UN Refugee Agency is rushing to relocate thousands of Central African refugees in the Democratic Republic of Congo away from the dangerous border areas to safer sites further inside the country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
An estimated 92,000 Central African refugees fled south into Congo late last year to escape election-related violence in their country. UN Refugee Agency spokesman Boris Cheshikov says they are living precariously in 40 remote places in the northwestern DRC.
Most Central African refugees are now living along riverbanks in hard-to-reach border areas, among host communities with extremely limited resources. Conditions are dire, with many refugees sleeping in makeshift shelters or out in the open. Most have little to no access to drinking water, sanitation, or food. Some have been welcomed by host families, sometimes up to three refugee families in a single home.
Cheshikov says the refugees must be relocated quickly because of the logistical difficulties of providing them with essential assistance where they are. He says it will become even harder to reach them during the coming rainy season when roads become impassable. Besides the need to provide food, shelter, and water, he says health needs are becoming increasingly urgent.
We have recently had a joint evaluation team among UN agencies, NGOs, and the local provincial health authorities, and we're very concerned that there might be a measles outbreak. There are already cases that have been registered. Only 30% of the refugee children have been vaccinated. We're calling for a vaccination drive.
Cheshikov says the UNHCR and the DRC's National Refugee Commission have started to develop a site for 10,000 refugees in Modal Village in North Ubangi province, and a second site is being considered in Basuele province. Additionally, he says four relocation sites will be prepared for some 35,000 refugees to live alongside local communities. These refugees, he says, will be able to grow their own crops and live a more independent life. As the needs of the refugees increase, the UNHCR says so do the funding requirements. The agency is urging the international community to respond generously to its recent appeal for $164.7 million so it can deliver life-saving support to these vulnerable people. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And in Japan, a new poll released Wednesday shows that 58% of Japanese say they do not want the Olympics to be held because of fears over COVID-19. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
A majority of Japanese people are opposed to holding the Tokyo Olympic Games this year due to concerns over the global health crisis. That's according to a Yomiuri Daily poll released on Wednesday. The Tokyo Games were already postponed last year and rescheduled for this July. While 70% of those surveyed said they were at least somewhat interested in the Summer Games, Yomiuri found that 58% were against holding the event this year. If the Games were to go on, over 90% said the crowd should be kept to a minimum or not allowed at all. The poll was conducted between mid-January through February, when much of the country remained under a state of emergency. A Reuters poll last month showed nearly two-thirds of Japanese companies also opposed holding the games this year, a shift from the last survey, which showed most in favor. As for now, Greater Tokyo remains in a state of emergency, with restrictions on gathering, business hours, and foreign travel into the country. Local media reported earlier this week that those restrictions are likely to extend 2 weeks longer than expected.
That was Brian Wood of Reuters. This is VOA. The International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor has launched an investigation into alleged crimes in the Palestinian territories. The decision turns the tribunal's focus toward Israeli military actions and settlements construction on lands captured in the 1967 Mideast War. It also raises the possibility of arrest warrants being issued against Israeli officials suspected of war crimes. Israel's government has conducted an aggressive public relations campaign to block the ICC investigation. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has condemned the decision as, quote, the essence of anti-Semitism and hypocrisy, end quote. Dozens of African migrants are feared to have died Wednesday after smugglers threw them overboard off Djibouti as they were en route to Yemen, hoping to enter Saudi Arabia to find work. Yvonne Ndege, a spokeswoman for the UN's International Organization for Migration, says their boat carrying 200 migrants left Olebi in Djibouti at 2 a.m. Citing survivors, Ndege says that half an hour later, the smugglers judged the boat was overloaded and threw at least 80 passengers off. She says five bodies have been retrieved so far. Four Ethiopians working with foreign journalists in the northern Tigray region have been released without charges, an official and media outlets said on Wednesday. Gurme Gebru, who is a reporter for the BBC's Tigrinya service, as well as two translators with Agence France-Presse and the Financial Times, and a journalist working with the New York Times, were detained in recent days, their outlets said. International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Farmers in North India have led a three-month-long protest against three agricultural laws that aim to reform India's farm sector, but which they fear will impact their livelihoods. Anjana Pasrika visited a village in Haryana state to talk to farmers about why they are standing firm with their demands that the laws be repealed.
Rampal grew up watching his village transform as high-yielding varieties of wheat and rice brought prosperity to the countryside in North India. It was called India's Green Revolution, but times have changed. The 63-year-old farmer says that over the last 10 to 20 years, his profits have dwindled steadily because of a huge increase in cost of inputs such as diesel, fertilizer, and seeds. A massive farmers' protest being held for over 3 months along Delhi's highways against three new farm laws is rooted in deepening discontent in villages like Daryapur. Farmer Bhagwan Dahiya says that his livelihood has become more precarious. High-yielding varieties have depleted soil nutrition and water tables. Extreme weather events that can ruin crops have become more frequent. He feels his labor does not fetch adequate returns, but he does not know what else to do. Dahiya says he has no choice but to farm his land. He is not educated, and even qualified people don't get jobs. He says it is not possible to move to another area of work when he is 45 years old. The disillusionment is echoed by others who mostly own small farms of less than 2 hectares. 19-year-old Manoj Gulia, who helps till his family farm, says they slog the whole day in the fields, but profits are slim. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has repeatedly assured farmers that the new laws will improve rural incomes and encourage private investment in the agricultural sector. But these villagers echo fears voiced at protest sites of being exposed to market forces at a time when they already face rising uncertainties. According to Gulia, farmers here are not so literate that they can negotiate with private players. He says that at least in the current system, they get paid. Some men from the village walk to local protest sites. Others travel in tractors to join the rallying cry of farmers, legalizing a decades-old practice of price guarantees set by the government for 23 crops.
Dahiya
says the government must enact a law to offer minimum prices because private players will not give farmers a good price without a legal guarantee. As farmers browse the newspaper for latest news of the protest, this countryside vows to support the campaign till the laws are scrapped, however long it takes. Anjana Basricha for VOA News, Daryapur, Haryana, North India.
Now we turn to the U.S., where nearly 4 months after a pro-Trump mob stormed the U.S. Capitol building, U.S. Capitol Police on Wednesday said they have intelligence showing a potential plot to breach the U.S. Capitol today, March 4th. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has more.
In a statement, the Capitol Police say they're ready for any potential threats on March 4th. That date used to be Presidential Inauguration Day, and the threat appears connected to a far-right conspiracy theory that Donald Trump will again rise to power March 4th. The statement was issued as the Capitol's acting police chief was testifying before a House panel and saying while there is concerning intelligence, she did not want to get into it publicly. The House's top security official told lawmakers this week there is no indication of groups coming to Washington to commit violence. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Also in the U.S., Republican state lawmakers are pushing restrictive voting bills in dozens of U.S. states. This follows the record voter turnout in the 2020 elections, which saw Democrats take the White House and control of the U.S. Congress. VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports from the Midwest state of Iowa.
More than 2 million Iowans were registered to vote in the 2020 general election, a record in a state with a population of just over 3.1 million. Of 1.7 million ballots cast in the state last November, more than 1 million were submitted through the mail as absentee ballots, also a record, as many voters shunned the polls during a pandemic. Then President Donald Trump, a Republican, won Iowa, but lost the national election to Democrat Joe Biden. Now, Republicans who control Iowa's state legislature have passed a bill limiting early in-person voting and shortening the time allotted for absentee ballot submissions, among other provisions. Bobby Kaufman is a Republican state representative.
But the job of the state government committee is to ensure election integrity. You look at what you did right, what you did wrong, and you make improvements. And that's exactly what we're doing here today.
What Republicans promote as preventing potential voter fraud, Democrats see as voter suppression. Eric Jurdy is a Democratic state representative.
We want to make the freedom to vote as easy as possible for every single Iowa voter. I have many constituents who work multiple jobs, are parents, and they need the flexibility to vote when they have the time.
Democrats failed to eliminate what they viewed as harmful restrictions on voting, and the bill passed the state House and Senate with unified majority Republican backing. Iowa is not alone, and Democrats are sounding the alarm. At a recent hearing in Washington, newly elected Georgia Democratic Senator John Ossoff said legislation advancing in his state would disproportionately deter minority voting.
For example, to end Sunday early voting, which is used heavily by black and working class voters.
Georgia and Iowa are among dozens of states where Republicans seek to rewrite voting laws.
It's pretty widespread, and it's not surprising to me, having worked in this area of voting rights for some time, to see a backlash against a high turnout election.
Michelle Cantor Cohen is with the Fair Election Center, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization addressing voting rights and election registration reform.
You know, one thing that I think is really telling is that there's no rationale for it being given that makes any sense. I mean, it's not as if there was, for example, a problem with the polls being open until 9 o'clock instead of 8 o'clock. In fact, you know, voters who work a long day may only be able to vote at that time.
Conversely, a lot of things that are meant to objectively suppress the vote have instead angered people and had them show up in record numbers.
Jessica Huseman with VoteBeat, an independent nonpartisan news organization covering election integrity, says not all the proposed reforms are problematic.
There are a lot of states, for example, whose deadlines for requesting absentee ballots were unrealistically close to the election. And so election administrators just didn't have enough time to get those ballots out the door and have voters return them. But there is certainly no reason to change broad swaths of the election system that we have now. You see states that I think are overcorrecting from perceived but not real problems from the 2020 election in order to satisfy the most extreme parts of their base.
Voting reforms in Iowa await the signature of that state's Republican governor. The first in what Huseman says could be a wave of voting changes in multiple states ahead of the 2022 U.S. midterm elections. Kane Faerbaugh, VOA News, Chicago.
German media are reporting that the country's BFV Domestic Intelligence Service has formally placed the far-right party Alternative for Germany, or AfD, under surveillance on suspicion of trying to undermine Germany's democratic constitution. The anti-immigrant AfD now becomes the first party to be monitored in this way since the Nazi era ended in 1945. The AfD won popularity in 2017 with voters who were angry with Chancellor Angela Merkel's decision to welcome more than 1 million migrants. But the AfD has been ostracized by other parties, which say its rhetoric contributes to an atmosphere of hatred that encourages violence against immigrants. Alexander Gulans, the AfD's parliamentary floor leader, says he believes there is an agenda to ban his party. And in Australia, according to a new survey, 1 in 5 Chinese Australians say they have been physically threatened or attacked because of their heritage in the past year. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The survey by the Lowy Institute indicates that a large majority of the Chinese community believe Australia is a good place to live, and most feel a sense of belonging. However, 18% of respondents said they've been intimidated or physically assaulted because of the pandemic and rising diplomatic tensions. About a third said they'd been verbally abused in the past year. Jennifer Su is a research fellow in the Public Opinion and Foreign Policy program at the Lowy Institute.
People did indicate that COVID-19 and Australia-China relations were the top two factors that affected their experiences of discrimination.
Su told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that despite the abuse, many Chinese Australians felt satisfied with their lives in Australia.
People have this sense of belonging despite the discrimination expressed, and they feel a sense of attachment to Australia. That says something about the strength of Australian society and Australia's multiculturalism.
Last year, China warned of a surge in racism in Australia, fueled by the novel coronavirus. Canberra's call for an inquiry into the origins of the virus was interpreted in Beijing as criticism of its handling of the crisis. Tensions have also been inflamed over allegations of Chinese interference in Australia's domestic politics and cyber espionage. Disagreements over broader geopolitical flashpoints have also been a source of antagonism, including Beijing's contentious territorial claims in the South China Sea, human rights, and Hong Kong's fragile democracy. China is Australia's biggest trading partner, but as the bilateral relationship frays, authorities in Beijing have imposed a range of economic sanctions and restrictions on a range of Australian goods, including barley, coal, and wine. Chinese immigration into Australia dates back to the 1800s. More than 1.2 million people of Chinese heritage currently live in Australia. Half migrated from China, and 10% were born in Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The Smithsonian is the U.S.'s largest network of museums and cultural institutions. For the last year and a half, it's been led by Lonnie Bunch, who is the first African-American and the first historian to helm the institution. VOA's Julie Tabo reports.
By unanimous vote, we have placed our trust in Lonnie G. Bunch III to be the 14th Secretary of the Smithsonian Institution.
On November 1, 2019, the Smithsonian Institution in Washington installed Lonnie Bunch as its 14th Secretary.
Congratulations, Mr. Secretary.
During his acceptance speech, Bunch shared a story about a 1960s road trip with his father.
He pulled in front of the Smithsonian, and then he said to me, "You could visit the Smithsonian, and not worry about being turned away by the color of your skin. I have never forgotten that moment.
Bunch is the first African-American and first historian to hold the Smithsonian's highest office.
I think of my grandfather and grandmother. You know, they started out as sharecroppers. And she used to take in other people's laundry and scrub other people's floors so her children and grandchildren wouldn't have to. Well, because they changed the trajectory, I am where I am. And so I want to make sure that what I can do is help change other people's trajectories.
As secretary, Bunch oversees the world's largest museum, education, and research complex, with 19 museums and the National Zoological Park. He has worked at the Smithsonian for decades.
The goal of the museum is to make America better.
Previously, he was the founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which has welcomed more than 6 million visitors since it opened in September 2016. The museum is devoted exclusively to exploring, documenting, and showcasing the African American story and its impact on American and world history. It's home to a collection of 40,000 objects.
The one that resonates with me that makes me cry every day is Emmett Till's casket, mainly because I became close to his mother as I was getting ready to leave Chicago.
Till was a black teenager who was kidnapped and brutally murdered by white men in Mississippi in the summer of 1955. Bunch recalls the strength of Till's mother.
What I realized is that the casket was really not a way to talk about Emmett Till's broken body, but it was a way to talk about the strength of women. Now, here is a black woman at the worst moment of her life, said, I will use that to challenge America, to reinvigorate or reignite the civil rights movement.
Since becoming secretary, Bunch has had to grapple with the challenge of the pandemic, which has forced the museums to close and focus more on their online presence.
We knew at the Smithsonian that we needed to be more digital. And if you have 39, 40 million people come to your door every year, you're like, wow, that's pretty good. But that's a small percentage of what could come to you digitally. It's been a moment where it's allowed me to begin to think about reimagining the Smithsonian, reimagining our educational output, reimagining how we serve the public, because my goal was not to simply get through the moment, but to use the moment to propel us forward.
To look forward while still remembering the past. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
That's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
60 years ago today, President John Fitzgerald Kennedy signed an executive order that established the Peace Corps. I'm hopeful that it will be a source of satisfaction to Americans and a contribution to world peace, said President Kennedy during the signing. The Peace Corps is a small independent agency administered by the United States government. Its field workers are volunteers, by and large educators and specialists in agriculture, health, community economics, and youth development. They work to improve the lives of people in underdeveloped or undeserved areas by increasing productivity and encouraging self-reliance. In its own words, the agency's mission is to help the people of interested countries in meeting their need for trained men and women, to help promote a better understanding of Americans on the part of the people served, and to help promote a better understanding of other people on the part of Americans. Indeed, more than anything else, the Peace Corps was designed to foster mutual understanding between Americans and other cultures of the world. Trained volunteers were, and still are, sent to live and work in developing countries around the world, helping the host country meet its need for skilled workers. And because they lived among the local populations, they learned and still learn about the people and culture around them. At the same time, the local people working and living alongside them get to know Americans as people, not much different from themselves. As of June 2019, some 235,000 volunteers have served in 141 countries. Each volunteer serves a two-year period with no pay except for a stipend to cover their room, board, and a few essential expenses. Their mission has adapted with the times and needs of the people they serve. Today, due to COVID-19 restrictions, no Peace Corps volunteers are stationed abroad. Their work in the field will continue once the pandemic is under control. To me, that's what the Peace Corps is all about, the impact that simple acts of service can have across borders, generations, and time, said President John Kennedy's grandnephew, Joseph Patrick Kennedy III. It's a lesson I carry with me every day.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and